The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, Disc 5.
My arrival at Madame Lou's felt considerably different today than it did when I viewed this part of town for the first time. I will not go so far as to say I'm comfortable with Chinatown, but I am at least familiar with this area of it, thus reducing my anxiety. Madame Lou, for her part, was most welcoming and accommodating. Again, I was in the company of Tina Coleman, and again, Tina was responsible for much of the social talk to introduce us. The Chinese insist on this social exchange before any business is discussed. Finally, Madame Lou glanced in my direction and spoke to me.
You wish another visit, child?
Yes, great lady. I followed Tina's lead wherever possible. She looked me over.
Something much troubling you?
Our home, I answered. Our house. She nodded, that enormous head falling forward like a stone. She wore a good deal of her hair in a bun at the back of her head, and yet the tail that spilled out of this nest was easily 2 feet long. All told, her hair must run 5 feet or longer, as tall or taller than she is herself.
I in contact with people, child, not houses.
Two women have disappeared in our house. One, a chambermaid. A young girl. She's there still, but no longer flesh and blood. I saw her with my own eyes. My handmaid saw her as well, I said, indicating Sukina. But the great lady would hardly acknowledge Sukina's presence. Tina Coleman gasped. Until that moment, I believe, she thought my entreaty might concern my marriage or my childbirth. At worst, the disappearance of Mrs. Fomantour. A second disappearance, previously unknown to her, and subsequent ghost sighting, appeared too much for her to bear. She engaged her fan, swiping the air with such force that some of her hair stood up on end. The big woman said,
I be little help to you, child. Not in house. Need be in house. Speak to missing women.
A seance?
Need be in house. Not for me. Madame Lou never leave neighborhood. Dangerous outside neighborhood.
But I could send a carriage, I said, immediately protesting. Tina leaned over and whispered, supplying quickly that Madame Lou would never leave this place. Any of the powerful Chinese caught outside their own fiefdoms were subject to the whims of city police. Madame Lou knew better than to challenge these long-held principles. The city's political structure is said to be rife with corruption, favor-peddling, and nepotism. The city runs exceptionally well for its businessmen, and no one is prepared to challenge its structure. I didn't like hearing any of this. I wanted to understand the goings-on at Rose Red. But I also recognized that despite the influence of my husband's name in some circles, in the world of Madame Lou, we barely existed. Tina spoke to the great lady, inquiring after someone who might perform the séance.
There is one I know, Lou said. Madame Stravinsky. Only one. No other. Come Seattle not often. I write letter and see.
I would be most appreciative, I said.
You suspect husband, she said bluntly.
I felt my breath catch in my throat.
Tell me why,
Madame Lou said. I glanced at Sukina, who looked as surprised as I did. Tina would not look in my direction. I wondered if I could speak freely in front of my friend. I saw no other course to take. I told Madame Lou about our recent experience in the barn, and young Laura in that awful state of undress, legs spread on the bed of that wagon, Sukina throwing the skirt. Laura, gesturing at my husband and his stable master. Madame Lou's face never changed. She looked at me impassively.
Has been dancing or celebration at house of late?
My husband is generous with a dispensation of spirit. At week's end, there is often music heard in the servants' quarters.
Place where husband or stable hand might seen young girl dancing like this?
The servants celebrate. It sometimes goes on all night, I'm told. Again, I checked with Sukina. Again, Madame Lou did not let on that Sukina even existed. My throat constricted.
Other lady missing. She no husband or stable hand?
Mrs. Fomantur, I said. Certainly not. She was a friend of Melissa Ray's, I said, pointing to my dear friend to my left. Tea was all. Tina Coleman looked over at me with a face I took for the dead. It held no color whatsoever. Her lips looked yellow, despite her application of color there. Dear friend? I asked. I wish to contradict this notion of yours, sweet Helen. Tina? As to the nature of the friendship between your fine husband, John, and my dear friend, Melissa Ray. They knew each other. She found her color as she blushed. John, well, he's been to the house on business, you see, many times. My husband is an investor with you, John. Did you know that? My head was spinning.
Perhaps,
I mumbled. It seemed to me I did know this, though I still did not make the connection that I should have made. They had met several times. Mrs. Ray and the widow, Fomantur. Your husband. Widow? I exclaimed.
They make friendship,
Madame Lou informed me, as if reading Tina's mind.
Your husband understanding man, yes? Feel badly, woman lost husband. Make friendship.
Tina confessed. There were several dinners, while you were with child and not feeling well. Dinners John attended without you. Madame Lou closed her eyes and added,
Husband offer his carriage.
And Melissa's visit to our house? I asked, my whole body numb. For tea? It was her idea to bring along her friend. Tell me it was so. Tina's lips quivered. She looked to the floor. Connie Fomantur asked Melissa to arrange it. John, it seems John would not return Connie's notes, and since it seemed unjust to Melissa that he should... For you see, she had confided in me the nature of their friendship. My husband and Mrs. Fomantur, I gasped. Are you saying what I think you're saying? Tina was in tears. Madame Lou looked carved from stone. The great lady said,
One must not look for that which one does not wish to see.
It sounded to me as if she were quoting. I'd never heard such a complete statement spoken by her. I want the truth, I said. I swear, I heard my words echo in that room.
Madame Stravinsky, Madame Lou said without hesitation. In Europe. I write note. I call for her.
Do we wait weeks? I asked. Months?
Years, Lou answered. Patience, my dear. In matters of the spirit, time is of little consequence.
January 16th, 1910. Rose Red. This day follows another extraordinary celebration at Rose Red, this time marking the second anniversary of our inaugural. To my great delight, the grand house remains under construction, at great cost to my husband. The facade of the house is much the same as a year ago, and so to the casual visitor, little would appear different than during the inaugural a year ago. But in fact, much has changed. I have ordered the complete remodel of the east wing of the third floor, an area of some 6,000 square feet, now designated Adam's Wing. Once complete, there shall be a child's library holding some 2,000 volumes, a recreation room, a train room, John's contribution, a small gymnasium, and a classroom. I wore the same gown as last year, repaired to look like new, and hoped to make this a tradition. I was so pleased to show the other women that I had recovered my form a scant 4 months following Adam's birth. Some women never recovered at all. The gowns were among the most beautiful I've ever seen, blue velvet being the most popular. We served nearly 75 more couples than last year, the invitation list growing with the popularity of the event. Thankfully, no one got lost or disappeared. How ridiculous that looks on your pages, dear diary. But oh, how I worried. I was in a frightful state all night, pacing the halls, escorting guests on tours, believing Rose Red might spoil our fun. And although the guests seemed to enjoy themselves, it required 3 tall flutes of champagne before I fully relaxed. Alas, our grand house allowed us to enjoy its existence. I wonder if it feels the presence of all the guests, if it celebrates along with us. There is little to tell, other than the usual rumors of mistresses and misconduct. What ills society spawns. Our head chambermaid, Mrs. Watson, reported to me this morning that a woman's full set of underclothes was found kicked under the bed of one of the guest rooms in the east wing. She apparently left the party with nothing beneath her gown, but that she was born with. Such stories abound at all the best parties. John stayed by my side most of the night, and I know even he is not rogue enough to attempt such a tryst at his own party, so I'm greatly relieved to know he had no part in this, or any other such assignation. In fact, after the guests were gone, nearly 4 in the morning, my husband, a bit tipsy, found his way into my chambers and occupied us both until the sun skimmed the horizon. He is quite the spectacular lover, my husband, and I must say it was time we came together as husband and wife once again. I know that he harbors certain reservations about my womanhood, well aware of the suffering I underwent at childbirth, and since then he seems to find it even a bit repulsive to think of touching me as a husband touches a wife. But the brandy apparently did the trick. He showed no reservation last night, and I returned a great deal of enthusiasm for the rite so that I might indicate my own satisfaction with his decision to visit my bed. Hopefully, another 4 months will not pass before he elects to do so again. I will admit, here to your pages, that I am ready this instant. Just the thought of John's embrace fills me with ardor. I detest myself for succumbing to this power he lords over me. After all his transgressions, and there I lie in my bed, hoping, dare I say it trembling, to hear his knock at my door. What kind of sickness accounts for such behavior in a woman? I dare not broach the subject with my friends, although Tina would be safe now that she knows so much. Our party was perfect. Following that, our time in my chambers was perfect. I wonder if things are on track again. I wonder if whatever force brought tragedy into this home is suddenly gone. Perhaps Rose Red is a house, a building, and nothing more. There is nothing to be afraid of. I repeat this phrase in my prayers, and yet do not fully believe the words. The memory of Laura's ghost lingers so boldly in my imagination. I want so badly to believe. Nothing to be afraid of. If only I could. July 10th, 1910, Rose Red. John's partner in Omicron Oil, Douglas Posey, and his wife, Phyllis, attended dinner tonight. We hosted six other guests, but they were inconsequential to the telling of this story. Our guests were invited, in part, to help us celebrate the amending of the state constitution in support of the suffrage movement. This week, Washington became the first state in the land to allow women the right to vote. It has been a hard-fought campaign, led by many of my friends on the hospital board, and John has brought out the champagne to lift our spirits. We dress the table in American flags, and will eat off red plates from the Far East, set on blue linen with white napkins. It's all very festive. I sensed tension between John and Douglas from the moment the Poseys arrived. Douglas has purchased a splendid new motor car that I know incites some envy on John's part. Within moments of the arrival, John took Douglas rather forcibly by the arm and escorted him into the gunroom off the central hall west. I heard raised voices, as did all the guests. The gunroom is a small masculine space, wood-paneled, with long glass displays containing John's collection of rifles. They started in the gunroom, but within minutes their voices were coming from the smoking room. One passes through a stair landing to reach the smoking room from the gunroom, and John must have taken Douglas by this route, or Phyllis and I would have seen them pass through the parlor. Our other guests were being served smoked salmon, Wisconsin cheese, and drinks in the tapestry gallery. Phyllis, as it turned out, wanted my ear as badly as John wanted his partner's. I believed the tension between Douglas and John arose from a European contract that John had approved, but Douglas had tied up in legal negotiations. Spain, it might have been. By delaying the contracts, another firm, Standard Oil of all companies, had negotiated a separate deal, essentially reducing Omicron's share of that market from 80% to less than 5%, and costing John and the company tens of thousands a year. It is funny how you can be so sure of something, only to find out how wrong you are. I could not have been more wrong about the cause of their squabble. Yes, Douglas Posey had delayed the contracts. Yes, it had cost John plenty. But the source of their disagreement was to come out in my secret and heated meeting with Phyllis, Douglas' distraught wife. She is a wife in name only, being some 15 years her husband's senior. In some ways, they, as a couple, are a direct opposite of John and me. While Phyllis has the business acumen, Douglas is the socialite. Phyllis, previously married and the mother of 5 grown adults, knows the ways of the world. Douglas is new to marriage and parenthood, just as I am. Beyond that, all comparison stops. Phyllis is a homely woman, wide of girth, deep of voice. Her black dress could have fit me twice over. She is in the habit of cupping her hand behind her left ear when one speaks to her on this side, the result of a childhood injury when a young boy struck her with a snowball that proved more ice than snow. She smelled too strongly of perfume. And though a pleasant enough perfume, I'm sure, it played bitter in her company, tangy and sharp on the back of the throat. She would have done better without it. I am vexed, she said, a big gush of wind as from a bellows. And I have no one to speak with, excepting you, dear child, for I do believe we are quite good friends. I hardly knew the woman at all. This told me quite a bit about her social skills. Her husband was the one with the smooth tongue. She should have been business partner with my John. If society had allowed it, John might have considered this possibility. What is it? I asked, somewhat anxious to get back to my guests in the tapestry gallery. Did John tell you? Oh, my, I can see he did not. She is a bit frightening when worked up. I think it's her size. John, it's Douglas, you see. Perhaps my fault when you get right down to it. She looked at me, blushed, and looked away. Oh, dear. Agitated to be kept from my guests, I was more forward than I might have otherwise been. If there's nothing to discuss... Oh, but there is. She produced a handkerchief from inside her sleeve. Dabbing her eyes, although I saw no tears, she continued. It's our ages, I'm sure. You're a young woman, Phyllis, I said as kindly as possible. She looks a bit homely. Boarding school when you get right down to it. I beg your pardon? Douglas, well, you see, he's always preferred the boys' locker room to the girls', if you follow me, dear. I did follow her. I hope I didn't turn too grave a shade of red. There had been talk. This was the first Phyllis had ever mentioned it. She said, it was a young man in the company. John, Douglas, everyone associated with Omicron calls it the company. An accountant, she said. A bookkeeper. She lowered her voice to where even I, as close as I was, could barely hear her. John walked in on them, you see, compromised as they were. Douglas's office of all places. She adjusted to her confession rather quickly, suddenly quite herself again. I've known since before we were married. He was quite upfront about it, dear man. Needed a wife to make the social circles, to be your husband's partner. I fit the bill quite nicely, despite the years I have on him. For my part, I don't ask much. I take a young man myself every now and again. She winked, and I found myself about to laugh. The idea of this woman with anyone was laughable. An experienced woman knows to marry for position. One's more physical desires are quite manageable outside the confines of that agreement. Was this how my own husband felt about it? Was our marriage made to suit the situation, while his appetites were another matter entirely? I did not share this attitude with my robust friend, but I kept thoughts on the matter to myself. Go on, I said. Well, it's just that. John caught him. Them. This very day. It explained John's foul mood. Usually, on the advent of a dinner party, he is quite entertaining, an enjoyable company. Tonight he had been snarly and gruff. I do believe he has a mind to punish my Douglas, she said, her jowls quivering. And what I've come to say to you, to ask you, to explain, is that Douglas is quite helpless in all of this. It's a bit like me and the gardener, she said with another of those disturbing winks. I hope John isn't too hard on him, in terms of the business. Ellen, Douglas works so very hard. To let him go? I blurted out. They're partners. He cannot fire him, she protested. Not for walking the other side of the street. I can tell you this, dear diary. My mother and her friends would never have discussed such things. Not ever. Not even cousins would discuss such transgressions. A man taking a boy was nothing new, except when he walked in your front door. They were stories, is all. Your friends did not do such things. But having had my own devilish temptations with the dark-skinned chambermaid, I knew that such lusts surfaced. I knew that fervent prayer was the only lasting answer. I knew that I still secretly looked at Tsukina in ways and at times that were more appropriate for a man. When Phyllis laughed at her own jokes, she looked pitiful. I reached out and held her hand. I assured her I would talk to John. You are a dear. But I warn you, John's his own man. I doubted this was news to Phyllis Posey, especially when it comes to business. And as to this other matter, the accountant, I rather suspect John will be more upset that it involved an employee, and that it was that they were in the office, and all. I didn't need these images in my head. More that than whatever choices Douglas has made. But it isn't a choice. Not for Dougie, it isn't. He's been this way since he was a young boy. He took to swimming, diving, the suits, you see, she said, as if this explained anything. I did not want to think about it. All that bare skin. I assumed her amusement stemmed from anxiety, from her nervousness about approaching the subject, for she dealt with this problem of her husband's in a most unusual way. For me, the conversation was far more revealing of my own situation than that of Douglas Posey. I could not influence John in this matter, nor would I try to do so. John is outspoken about homosexuals and has told me so often. He seems less troubled with women finding mutual romance than men. He has expressed openly to me the indecency of one man touching another in any such intimate manner. This, from a man who installs hidden mirrors in the lady servants' quarters. I can just imagine him lustily looking on as one girl soaps the back of another. But Phyllis's explanation of their marriage of convenience reflected foully on my mood. Had I, in fact, been viewed as nothing but a broodmare, a fear that had lingered in my heart for far too long already? Had John justified his unfaithfulness by qualifying our marriage as one of convenience? Good family, good pedigree, breed her, and keep her on to raise the children while he takes to the streets to satisfy his more pressing needs. Disgust welled in my heart, a bitter taste at the back of my throat. I spent the dinner as something less than a gracious hostess, as preoccupied by these new concerns. I drank a little too much wine. John and Douglas Posey had emerged from the smoking room with their contempt barely disguised. I don't believe they shared another word all evening, not even so much as a handshake goodbye. I retired to my room, where Tsukina helped me get ready for bed, and I nursed dear Adam. I think he may walk any day. He crawls. He's fast as lightning, and pulls himself up and looks at me with the sweetest face as if to say, "Do I dare, Mama?" Tsukina and I encourage him. If there's one thing a Rimbauer needs, it's independence and strength. The air was still, the night terribly hot. I lay naked on my bed, debating whether to wear a nightgown on such a stifling night. The night nurse had returned Adam to his room. Tsukina had gone to my dressing room to put away my silk hosiery and the black heels I'd worn to dinner. I felt the wine as a penetrating heat. John knocked and opened the door before I answered, and he saw me exposed there on the bed. It is odd, but rarely does John see me without my clothes. On those nights he comes to my bed, it is already dark as he slips in beside me. During our honeymoon, he afforded me privacy, believing me modest, I suppose. And indeed, I did blush quite a bit in those first few days with my husband. But last night, he threw open the door and saw me there, fully exposed as I was, and something came over him. He has rarely shown me the level of interest as he did in the moments after his discovery. He locked the door behind himself and was half undressed by the time he reached my bedside. I opened my mouth to warn him of Sukina's presence, but his mouth was on mine before those words found their way out. My God, was he excited! I must confess, my attention was not fully on my husband, knowing that my handmaid was basically in the room with us, and the electric lights still on. Sukina had no escape, for there is no exit from the dressing rooms other than through my chambers. She could not have escaped our union if she had wanted to, and I'm sure she did. As John unleashed more ardor toward me than perhaps ever before, we had a witness. Was he trying to erase the thoughts of Douglas Posey's fascination with boys? Was he drunk to the point that a naked woman prone on fresh linen was too much to bear, even if it was his wife? Whatever the case, his advances, the lengths to which he went, which will certainly not be discussed here, reminded me that a man and a woman can still make discoveries about each other well into a marriage. I bit down on my wrist and finally took to stuffing a corner of a pillow into my mouth before I woke half the city. In the midst of our most excited moment, I glanced over John's shoulder, only to see Sukina's dark face staring out from the doorway to the dressing rooms. Sukina, smiling back at me. And though I cannot explain it, the knowledge of her there, looking on, drove me to a heightened passion. Finally, I slumped back to the headboard, sweating and panting, and flushed from my chest to my knees. Without a word, John redressed, kissed my forehead, and left my chambers. A moment later, Sukina slunk from the shadows of the dressing room and made for the door. "Don't go," I said. "Sukina, sorry, Miss Allen." "I'm not, dear friend. I should not have looked." "I don't mind that you did." She looked at me timidly. "Sukina, sorry," she repeated. "It isn't always like that." "The heat, Miss Allen, the heat, too strange thing to a man." She moved toward the bed cautiously, for though she had seen me fully undressed 100 times, never quite in the state I was. "A pillow, miss." She indicated my bottom. "Use the pillow. You want the child." Another child. My heart skipped little beats. "Use the pillow. You want a child." I used 2 pillows, though I suspected none was needed. Never had my husband been quite like that. I imagined that if ever there was cause for a woman to be with child, I had just experienced such a moment. And I know that I am right. I am with child. If true, it will be a spring baby. April 9th, 1911, Rose Red. We will call her April, for that is the month of her birth, but the devil delivered this child, and the devil's she is. The childbirth was unbearable. The doctor working at my bedside for nearly 7 hours to save my life and that of my child. She has been born with a withered arm, and I'm told that arm would not allow a proper birth, and so they cut me, and then cut me some more, and finally took the baby by a means only ranchers use. But, thankfully, my doctor was raised on a sheep ranch. She lives, little April, with bright blue eyes and John's sturdy looks. She will be my last child, I'm told, and I've been sick with grief over it. They saved my life, but not my womanhood. Whatever accounts for a woman having babies, I am now without. Barren. Just the thought of it prevents me from getting out of bed. I have not left my bed in a week. April was born on the first day of the month, the second anniversary of Laura's disappearance. Not that the doctor would let me get up, but I wouldn't have, even if he had allowed it. No more children. No more reason to be in this family with this man whose seed is so foul as to wither the arms of his young. For Sukina explained that my illness in Africa is to blame for April's deformity. I hate my husband. I hate my life. I hate this house that holds us all like prisoners. I shall stop writing now, for I hate even you, dear diary. I hate reading back and seeing a time where a choice still existed in my life. What have I done? Who is this creature I have married who would, intentionally or not, poison our children in conception? Who are these whores he takes up with that their venom ends up in the roots of our family tree? I hate them all. You, them, everything. May 21st, 1911. Rose Red. My mood has improved in the weeks since my last entry. I could not even look at these pages for so long, could not review the decline of my life and the tragedy of my marriage. Today, in the blossoms of spring and the music of the songbirds, I sit in the garden with Adam playing ring toss with his nanny, with April at my side, your pages open on my lap, a pen in hand. I am delighted to say another maid has gone missing. Giddy, even. It is a girl identified by Sukina as having had intimate relations with John prior to that hot July night when April was conceived. It is a girl I wanted fired, but one whom Sukina suggested remain in our employ. And then I understood. It was then I fixed my prayers to this girl. Prayers made to the other side. I begged for her demise. I offered my April's withered arm as example of evil. And I waited patiently for a response. Sukina made a doll. She covered it in black paper and hid it in a drawer. Today, we have our answer. While John and the rest of the house mill about anxiously searching for the young waif, I sit proudly quiet in the sunlight of the garden, a wry grin allowed upon my lips. Let them bring on the police. Let them bring on the dogs. They will not find her. Let them ask all the questions they like. They cannot conceive of the truth. Ah, there's that word conceive again, appropriate as ever. The police have no idea of the spirit that inhabits this place. If they did, they would burn her to the ground, burn her like a witch. Rose Red has claimed another disloyal subject. And I swear she feeds off it. She looks bigger today. She does. More impressive than ever. Or perhaps it's just me. Such a fine, fine day as this. I mark it here in your pages for little April to someday know that her arm has been avenged, at least partly. I'm not sure I'm done with my prayers just yet. I laugh into the sunshine. Little Adam looks up and laughs along with me. The nanny looks slightly disturbed at this levity, given the disappearance, but I laugh just the same. Let them call me crazy if they want. I've connected to Rose Red. I do believe that I'm beginning to understand her. June 23rd, 1912. Rose Red. With dear little April over a year old, and young Adam growing like a weed, I reflect on the year just past, and how our lives here at Rose Red have finally settled down. Perhaps this can be attributed to the fact that John took nearly 4 months in Europe and the Far East, opening up new business for the oil company. His geologists believe there is oil to be found under the deserts of Saudi Arabia, of all places, and John has put this and neighboring countries under contract to allow Omicron to explore. With John gone, the house seemed to take a rest, and once again I found myself discounting my suspicions that Rose Red could be thought of as a person. Today, I have dreamed a horrible thing. Just how it will affect those of us at Rose Red, I have not the slightest. In my dream, a bridge collapsed. It was very high, spanning a torrent of water, not unlike Niagara Falls, where John and I visited following our return to New York from our year abroad. This bridge fell into that torrent and killed dozens of people, their screams swallowed by the roar that engulfed them. It is not my first vision. It shall not be my last. I admit to you, dear diary, that I have not felt terribly stable since praying that young tart into the clutches of this grand house. Sukina, God bless her, has gotten to the truth of the young vixen, Delora, the Christian name of the girl, and it was nothing like I thought it was. I bear the burden of a tremendous guilt over my prayers now. According to one of our Oriental maids, a girl named Kathy, Delora White had complained to her about her situation with the carriage master, not knowing what to do. It seems that, like young Laura, one of her assignments took her to the carriage house at least once a week, sometimes twice. It was here that Daniel began to ask questions, often just following a visit, on arrival or departure by my husband, in motor car or on horseback. The questions seemed peculiar to Delora. How often she got out, whether or not she had boyfriends on the staff, where she came from, how often she spoke to her family. But the real questions that stung her were about loyalty to the family, the Rimbauers, to John and me, to John. She reportedly replied that she owed the family everything and would do anything for us. This is as much as Sukina knows, but I fear I have done this child wrong by my prayers to remove her. It sounds to me as if Daniel, at the very least, and quite possibly John himself, has been working with the minds of the young housemaids, testing how far their loyalty will carry them. To what end, I need not guess. What else could Daniel be asking of girls like Delora, but to submit to a man's needs? Theft? This house does not need money. Deceit? To what end? No, I think it is quite clear what Daniel asked of her. What intrigues me now, however, is my mistaken assumption that my prayers were responsible for Delora's disappearance. Perhaps not. Perhaps I do not know this house as well as I thought. Perhaps Rose Red herself feels sorry for these young girls, holding them in her arms as she does while they are in the midst of unspeakable acts demanded of them by their employers. Perhaps these disappearances are missions of mercy, not of condemnation. What if she is protecting them from within? What if their blind loyalty to this house later causes guilt on the part of the very house to which they've sworn their loyalty? What choice would Rose Red have but to save them from themselves? to transport them through her walls to rooms where they will live safely forever. This might further explain why men die and women disappear in these halls. Now more than ever, I wish to commune with Rose Red, to enter within her and divine answers to these outstanding questions. Madame Lou once offered to put me in touch with Madame Stravinsky, and I am remiss for not following up on this offer. Whether a month or a year away, I feel the absolute necessity for a séance, here, on this property, with my husband in attendance. I am amazed that John has expressed an interest in both he and Douglas Posey attending. He's openly curious about the event. Perhaps Laura is there and can speak. Delora? Maybe the grand house, the lady herself, would condescend to communicate with those of us responsible for her birth and growth. I feel lightheaded with just the thought. A séance! The chance to hear the voice that lurks behind the walls of this enormous edifice. Rose Red, here, in person. I shall not make another note in these pages until that day does come. June 24th, 1912. Rose Red. Reading back, I see I lied. Here I am, writing again already. I can't leave your pages. Oh, dear diary, tell me this isn't happening to me. First my daydream about the bridge during yesterday's nap. Then today in the paper, front page news that the bridge at Niagara Falls collapsed yesterday. 47 people fell to their deaths. How did I know? How did I see this as it was happening? What power lurks inside me? What is happening to me? I know the answer. Rose Red has found her ways into my dreams, into my soul, and I am powerless to stop her. July 23rd, 1912. Rose Red. John is quite excited by the possibility of war. I will never understand men, except to say that John believes it will expand his oil business considerably, and if there's a way to gain riches, John Rimbauer is ever aware. There are reports today that the Brits have ordered their powerful navy into the North Sea in a build-up against the Germans. These same reports say that the Germans attempted to corner the Brits into signing a mutual declaration of neutrality, but the Brits would have none of it. John believes a business trip to Europe is imminent, perhaps for as long as 6 months or so, and has asked that the children and I join him. To be free of Rose Red. I accepted his offer immediately, until he informed me that Tsukina would have to stay to make room for the children's nannies. I am unsure how to interpret his request. Is it that he has come to fear Tsukina and her insights? Does he know about her questioning some of the staff about Delora's disappearance? Does he wish to leave her behind with me away so that harm can come to her? Or is it that he's lifting the skirt of one of the nannies with me unaware? I withdrew my acceptance immediately, and John stood his ground. The offer for a European trip stands, but Tsukina is to remain behind. I postponed my answer for a day or two. Meanwhile, I must make Tsukina busy. There is more here than meets the eye. November 10th, 1912. Rose Red. I write with little Adam about to fall asleep on my lap, pressed against my bosom, his small face warm, his little hands twitching as he can't decide whether to sleep or get up and roam the room. I have dismissed his nanny, Miss Susan McConnell, for the present, content to be alone with my child, the heir to Rose Red. Oh, heart, how can I love so? My children fill and occupy a place in me that sings of contentment and satisfaction. If only I had known life could be so fulfilling and whole. I fear I married for all the wrong reasons, society and wealth, when in fact one should marry for family and love. I know now. I am driven to these thoughts, no doubt, because John is still away in Europe. I considered taking the children, traveling with him, but used the excuse of an epidemic influenza in that part of the world to remain at home. In protest of his refusal to allow Sukina to attend me on the voyage. I pray for my husband's health. I have had a letter or two. He writes of business and the likely expansion of war, one of a very few who might benefit by that prospect. I hear little of his social activities beyond the mention of the occasional dinner with a few of our acquaintances, and my wife's heart fears the worst. I know the man he is. Live and learn. It troubles my imagination to think of him alone in his 5-room hotel suite, his chauffeur-driven motor cars, his late dinners, and his brandies. As to events here at Rose Red, I am saddened to report the death of our stable master, Daniel, one of my husband's most devoted employees. I have written John of our loss. I know this news will devastate him, but he will not receive the post for another several weeks at the earliest, and by then Daniel will be buried and all but forgotten. One can imagine such accidents are commonplace enough for stable hands, and thanks to some quick thinking on the part of Daniel's staff, this house was spared another round of scandal. But mark my word, this man's horrific death was no accident. In point of fact, Rose Red reached down and took another man's life. The fourth such accidental death in a little over 2 years' time. Officially, the police determined he was trampled to death, found as he was in the stall of a young stallion who is known to get quite high of spirits when fed straight oats, a misfortune of inexperience on the part of one of the stable boys who fed him a bucketful. In point of fact, Daniel was found in the very same wagon stall where Sukina and I witnessed the ghostly specter of Laura's misfortune. Mind you, dear diary, there is no horse in this stall to have trampled poor Daniel to death. And as stated earlier, only the sharp wit of a stable hand, who moved Daniel's broken corpse to the stall occupied by Black Thunder, and then relayed straw in the wagon stall to cover the spillage of blood, saved us from the undue attention of the police and society. This house and its employees have seen so many bizarre events that we have begun to protect one another. The fast-thinking stable hand, a boy named Dirk, shaken as he was by the events of the evening, was provided several bottles of claret, subsequently drinking himself to unconsciousness. Sukina's remedy, as she wisely suggested, I quickly buy this boy's silence while formulating a plan. In John's absence, the running of this house falls firmly on my shoulders. In the morning, I plan to offer him a month's wages and promotion to stable master for his silence. I once believed trouble comes in threes. Now I simply believe that trouble comes. One learns to get out of its way. Daniel invited trouble and was, at least in the opinion of this great house, expendable. My husband, who may or may not be guilty, all evidence suggests he is too valuable to Rose Red to be sacrificed. No matter what others may believe, it is my conviction that Rose Red is behind all of this. She brings out the worst in men. She gobbles up women. She judges, sentences, and condemns. I am told that Daniel was so badly trampled that only his belt and boots lent to his identification. He was not killed, but executed. Another life passes through Rose Red. Another life is claimed. The scriptures have never been more accurate in their promise of hell for those who sin. Just ask Daniel. Why this pleases me so, I do not know. I feel guilt over the pleasure I take in such matters. Yet whatever force did spirit Mrs. Fomantur and the others away, to points unknown, also left the corpses of 4 men behind. 5, if you count poor Mr. Corbin, who will rot in jail, to pay for their part in whatever activities occupy the long nights at Rose Red. She is watching us all. And though John may claim the title, or even pass the mantle to me in his absence, we would all be well to acknowledge that there is only one master of this house. It is a mistress, indeed. It is the house itself. She governs all. No one leaves without her permission. September 4th, 1914. Rose Red. The events of the past several years are too numerous to recall. Concerned that my writing this diary somehow contributed to the disappearances and deaths here at Rose Red, I have abstained from these pages for far too long, especially given that 2 more women have vanished from our grounds, one a gardener, the second a gypsy child, whose very presence here is questionable. This second disappearance brought the police once again, this time at John's urging, since accusations included that John had been seen with the woman in the Docklands the night before. Thankfully, this rumor was put to rest. John was nowhere near the Docklands that night. He and I had attended a hospital dinner, not returning home by motor car until well after midnight, both of us retiring to our chambers. Now, with the war raging in Europe, with John away more than he is at home, with Sukina claiming that several times she has seen all the missing women dancing together in the grand ballroom, I find I must pick up my pen and write. You, dear diary, were never the cause of any of this, and I was a fool to think so. Once again, I entrust my most private thoughts to your pages, confident that only my eyes shall ever read these words. Woe be to anyone, anywhere, at any time, who violates the privacy of these pages. May a curse be upon you. If you have read any of this, you know these pages are for me, and me alone. They picked a new pope yesterday in Rome, Benedict the 15th. I am Protestant, as is John, but I wish the Pope would visit our grand house and explain what or whose spirit it is that possesses it. The Indians? I fear it is them. They have graves to fill, graves that we dug up. Surrogates will do, I suppose. Please form a line, like a ticket box office for a show. Sukina tells me that the staff thinks I am crazy, that I have lost my mind. We chuckle at this together. I do spend a good deal of time in my chambers, for my African fevers reoccur, sometimes for days, or even weeks at a time. The rest of my time is spent in the gardens or alone with the children, rarely taking dinner with John or showing myself around the house. The children occupy my every well moment, my every well thought, and let the servants think what they think. No person should be made to endure such fevers, and I fear my April, who also suffers horrible ills, shall die of my husband's vile poison if I don't seek a solution outside of what medicine can offer. For her part, Sukina is my sister now, having taken the place of your pages these past several years, listening for hours on end to my complaints, my fears, and my loves. It has brought us closer than I ever imagined two people could come. She knows my every thought before I think it, anticipates my every need before I voice it. If I did not know better, I should think this dear woman is reading my mind. The reason for my taking up my pen, the news that I write of here, is this. After nearly 3 years of waiting, 3 years of repeated appeals, my wishes have been heard. Madame Stravinsky is to hold a séance in this house this very evening. I am so excited. We've invited 8 guests, including the Posies. John has resigned himself to participation. I believe the curiosity is killing him. Needless to say, of those invited, all women save John and Douglas, some may believe such an endeavor foolish. A necessity, in my opinion, for I wish to judge their reactions. Should Madame Stravinsky connect with the other side, I wish to measure my own beliefs against those around me. Sukina has openly expressed her hostility for the Madame Stravinskys and the Madame Lus of this world. Sukina's powers and abilities in this regard are beyond question. Partly because of Sukina's distrust, I have invited only dear friends whose opinions I can rely upon, whether believers in the supernatural or not. Time will tell how we judge this enterprise. Excitement fills the air. All but 4 servants have been asked to remain in the dorms or dwellings. Madame Stravinsky does not want any human disturbance inside this house when she attempts to make contact. I await this evening in the way April or Adam awaits what lies beneath the Christmas tree. September 4th, 1914. Rose red. Evening. I had to run back upstairs and jot down this note because I do not want to lose these thoughts to the séance that is scheduled to start momentarily. The event is to take place in the ladies' library, to the north of the grand stair, beyond which lies the billiard room. We should never have designed such a feminine space to adjoin any such male haven, even if not connected by a doorway. Sukina and I were checking up on Madame Stravinsky, a withered old woman dressed in colorful silks and shawls and wearing excessive jewelry about her wrists that clatters with every twitch of the hand, as she had asked to spend time in the room alone, preparing herself for the séance. Sukina suggests she is preparing the room as well, the implication of fraud apparent. As we re-entered to check up on her, I did overhear my husband's shrill complaints to Douglas Posey through the bookshelves and wall that are shared with the billiard room. John made it quite clear to Posey that their interests were no longer the same, that war presented unparalleled opportunities, and that not to exploit such times out of a fear of being seen as ruthless was to miss the point of war entirely. "War is born of profit and loss," he thundered, "in varying degrees, whether speaking economically or in terms of human life. Profit and loss. Which side of the equation would you suggest we fall on? Yes, We're strangling the competition. Yes, we've cut deals with the Europeans, but not the Germans, Douglas. We are not turncoats. We are businessmen, holding down supply on the one hand, while profiting greatly in the other. And costing our own military in the process, Posey complained. Profiting by denying a free market. Profiting from government war money while controlling that market for ourselves. I won't have it. I won't be a part of it. Business. Profit and loss. An oil company is in business to make money. I want out. I'm going to sell my shares. No. I have every right. Read the partnership papers. You sell your shares now, and people will question the stability of the company. It's always the case. Now, of all times. No, Douglas, you mustn't. You can't stop me. I'll buy them from you. What? Posey's shock registered. The partnership also provides for that. With what? We have every cent into that Texas pipeline. Leave that to me, my husband said. I confess, I feel John is making a huge mistake. Douglas Posey's shares have to be worth millions. John will have to go to every banker he knows. He might bankrupt us. I will pay cash, and though we must report the sale to regulators, we will make nothing of it in the press. Neither you nor I. You owe me that, Douglas. Where would you be without Omicron? A good deal happier, I expect, Posey said. I owe you nothing. You owe me your shares, my husband said, in a voice that brought chills even to me. A room, a world away. I expect, had it been the gunroom instead of the billiard room, one or both would have laid dead on the floor. And you shall have them, Douglas Posey said. With haste, Sukina and I made it into the central hall east, in advance of my husband and his partner leaving the billiard room, the click of the door opening behind us. We hurried the length of that splendid corridor and ducked into the grand ballroom instead of allowing ourselves to be spotted loitering at the base of the grand stair. John would not take kindly to even the possibility of eavesdropping. He guarded his business dealings in the cloak of extreme secrecy and attributed his success in part to this. Winded and out of breath, Sukina and I pressed our backs alongside the great oil paintings that dominate the grand ballroom. We could reach the entry hall to our right and the parlor just beyond, where my guests were waiting the commencement of our séance. I have sneaked up just now to powder my nose, to make note of this encounter in your pages. I shall now return to the ladies' library to meet our guests and our guest of honor. I know not what lies in store, but it has been an eventful evening already, and it hasn't officially started. September 5th, 1914, Rose Red. I could not wait until the light of morning to put to pen the events of this evening. I shudder with fear and delight at what I have just experienced, and shall endeavor to put it down here, just as it happened, from start to finish. Madame Stravinsky is seated when my guests and I are summoned to the ladies' library. A little giddy, perhaps apprehensive, as it were, we were directed into our seats by the wizened woman and told to remain silent. Only Sukina stays standing in defiance of the instructions, directly behind our guest of honor. The two exchange furtive glances, Sukina winning the day, and Madame Stravinsky makes no more of it. At this point, not to be outdone, my husband stands from his chair and starts an energetic pacing that continues from this point forward. Madame Stravinsky, understanding from whose pocket her hefty fee was to come, proves in no mood to challenge John, and a good thing, too, given his obvious agitation and disapproving nature. This leaves Douglas Posey the only man at the table. I sit facing her, at the opposing head of the table. Between us, in the center of the great oval table, rests her crystal sphere, a glass object the size of a human head, which sits upon a jeweled base of gold, or similar metal, and proves to be within the extended reach of the medium. She calls for the lighting of candles and the extinguishing of all electric lights in the grand house. Thankfully, she made these instructions earlier, upon her arrival, for it required 3 of our 4 staff on hand and nearly 40 minutes to render the house in darkness. Alas, it is but a minute or 2 to secure the various rooms of the ground floor, and for our staff to return to light the candles and dim this room's electric lamp for good. At that time, our medium calls for total silence. Only our breathing and John's impatient footfalls disturb this peaceful blanket. Next, Madame Stravinsky calls upon us all to connect by hand. Only Tsukina refuses this instruction. Even John joins in the fun, moving his chair between me and Tina, taking my hand, but interlacing his fingers in hers. This was my first experience with jealousy where Tina is concerned. What was it I sensed between my husband and my best friend? Dare I think such a thought? Are such suspicions founded? Or do I see deceit and deception around every corner now? With all of us holding hands, and only the dim flicker of candlelight shifting shadows on the walls of books, Madame Stravinsky closes her eyes, asks us to bow our heads, and speaks in a chilling, unvarying tone. Great house that does surround us, open your doors to a visitor who has come to greet you. She speaks in Russian or German next, perhaps repeating herself. I cannot be sure. My husband speaks a little of both. Perhaps he understood her mumblings. I must admit to a certain degree of awe. Whether it was just my own body or an effect divined by Madame Stravinsky, I swear to your pages that the temperature of the room did drop substantially. I also swear that the flickering flames of those candles did dance from the wicks as if a door had been thrown quickly open and a gust of wind had entered the room. Madame Stravinsky is, by now, locked in something of a trance, her head bowed slightly, her eyes closed. I see across the table to my guests, my friends, and observe their astonishment, for clearly they expected a hoax, not the events we have just witnessed.
This ends Disc 5.